Association. It's simpler than it seems. It's an easy way to make a donation, and your gift will do something even greater than creating a profit. It will help save lives. Donate before December 31st, and you'll quickly receive the benefits of your gift. To learn more about the advantages of a stock donation to the American Heart Association, call 1-800-242-8721. Take stock in life.
Complicated. Maneuvering a hot air balloon through a wind farm.
Uncomplicated. Helping give someone a second chance at life.
From Ann Arbor, Michigan, on the Genesis Communication Network and the World Wide Web, this is Veterans Radio. And now here's your host, Dale Throneberry.
Good evening and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Throneberry and I will be your host this evening in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan, not too far from the Detroit Tigers Comerica Park, who are now the American League champions. So, but for everybody out there who didn't think they could do it, yeah, we did it. It's incredible. I was fortunate to be down there on Friday night. It was a great game, and we didn't freeze too much. So now we're ready for whoever comes along next. And the Lions won today, too. So what else could be going right? Well, today happens to be my grandson's birthday. So happy birthday, Alex. Wanted to let you know that I was thinking about you, even after the party at Chuck E. Cheese. We've got a lot of things we're going to be talking about tonight. Mostly we're going to be talking about the photograph of Iwo Jima and the photograph that captured America. And joining us on our program this evening is going to be the writer of a new book, Hal Buell. And the book is called Uncommon Valor, Common Virtue. And we're going to be talking with him about that picture and Joe Rosenthal, who recently passed away, and the circumstances that surrounded that picture a little bit. Also, I want to be talking about why Iwo Jima was so important to the Allied move across the Pacific toward Japan, and we're going to find out why. Also, of course, Iwo Jima was the bloodiest battle that the Marines participated in during World War II. Also joining us on the line later on will be a personal friend of Joe Rosenthal, and his name is Dan Cortez, and he's a friend, and he's going to tell us a little bit of the story, the personal story of Joe and some of the problems that he had with people because they thought for some reason that this picture had been staged. So we'll talk about that with Hal and with Dan, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But right now, we're going to be doing our Welcome Home segment. And this is getting better every week. I'm really excited to welcome all these troops home this week. Welcome Home is sponsored by Gary Lilly and Associates, commercial realtors. So give Gary Lilly a call at 800-345-6694 or visit Gary on the web at GaryLilly.com and tell him that you heard about him on Veterans Radio. Each week on Veterans Radio, we like to welcome home servicemen and women who have been stationed around the world in the service of their country. And this week, we've got a lot of people that we can welcome home. Soldiers from the Army Reserves in Bethany, Missouri, returned home on the 29th of September. Members of the Rhode Island Army National Guard's 43rd Military Police Brigade also returned home. Wichita Falls, Texas, threw a welcome home party for Army Specialist Jessica Wilson. I think it's great when a town does that. Also this week, in Phoenix, Arizona, this is kind of an unusual event, occurred on Thursday the 12th. The Arizona Purple Heart recipients were honored in a welcome home celebration at the ABC Channel 15 studios in Phoenix. 65 soldiers from the 738th Area Support Medical Company returned home to the National Guard Armory in Indianapolis, Indiana. Over 100 members of the 1st Battalion, 117th Field Artillery National Guard unit returned home to Andalusia, Alabama on Thursday. 120 soldiers from the 452nd Ordnance Company, the Army Reserves in Aberdeen, Kansas, returned home to Fort Riley, Kansas on Monday. And finally for this week, the B Company 46th Engineer Battalion unit arrived home at Fort Rucker, Alabama. And I just want to welcome them all home. It's great that they're there. Unfortunately, they're being replaced by full-time military. And it's getting stretched a little thin out there, folks, so we need to talk about that at another time. But right now, we want to give everybody a nice welcome home.
The military is the last honorable profession. Those people have taken a vow that, if necessary, they will give up their life for our country. That's not give up part of their pay or give up some vacation days. They will give up their life for our country. Those words were delivered at a national convention of Vietnam Veterans of America by Vietnam veteran Captain Dale Dye, United States Marine Corps retired and military consultant to Hollywood luminaries Tom Hanks, Oliver Stone, and many others. My name is Gary Lilly, and as a proud Vietnam veteran, I ask, can we do any less than support the brave men and women in today's military? Gary Lilly and Associates Realtors is proud to sponsor this segment of the Veterans Radio. For your commercial real estate and vacant land needs, go to www.garylilly.com or call 800-345-6694. Gary Lilly and Associates Realtors.
Hi, this is Dale Thronberry from Veterans Radio, and I want to know how many of you are suffering from some sort of chronic pain. If you are, then you're one of millions of people our age who just kind of just live with that pain. I strongly suggest you give Quantum Physical Therapy a call at 734-483-9200. That's 734-483-9200. Quantum Physical Therapy is located at 5417 Whitaker Road in Ypsilanti Township, right off I-94 on exit 183. Quantum Physical Therapy is a multifaceted facility providing cutting-edge conventional and alternative rehabilitation services. Their core business is orthopedic and sports physical therapy, but they will also provide extensive occupational and pain management services for you. They are the movement experts and are committed with coming up with a specific solution to your specific problem. Whether it's pain, weakness, swelling, nerve injury, amputation, disease, surgery or trauma of any kind, they can help you continue to lead a productive and fulfilling life. That's Quantum Physical Therapy, 734-483-9200, or on the web at gptherapy.com, and tell them that you heard about them on Veterans Radio. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and tonight we're going to be talking about the picture that Joe Rosenthal took on February 23rd, 1945, on the top of Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima. And my guest joining us on the radio to begin with is Hal Buell. And Hal Buell is a veteran photo editor who has spent more than 40 years with the Associated Press, 25 of them as head of the International Photo Service. He's a graduate of the MEDIL, I guess it is, School of Journalism at Northwestern University, and he's talking with us from New York. Good evening, Hal.
Good evening. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio.
My pleasure.
Well, before we get into actually talking about the picture, can you give us a little background on the Battle of Iwo Jima?
Well, Iwo Jima was another one of those little tiny islands in the Pacific, and an especially small island that only measured 5-6 square miles and about 4.5 miles long. But it was a strategic island because one of the problems they were having was that the bombers that would leave from Saipan to hit Tokyo and Osaka and other Japanese cities had to go without fighter escort because the fighters couldn't make that trip. The bombers could carry sufficient fuel, but not the fighters. So they wanted to get there were two airfields on Iwo Jima, and they wanted to get a hold of those airfields because fighters could make the run from Iwo Jima to Japan and back, and therefore give the bombers air support in their bombing runs. And secondly, the island was then also a safe haven for bombers that were hit over Tokyo. They could get, if they could make it to Iwo Jima, they could land there. And in fact, 2,000 bombers landed on Iwo Jima after it was taken in those last months and weeks of the war. And finally, Iwo Jima was part of the home island of Japan. It was actually administered by Tokyo. It was a lot like Staten Island in New York, except it was 750 miles removed from Tokyo. But putting the American flag or any foreign flag on Iwo Jima would be the first time in Japanese history that a conqueror's flag or the foreign troops invaded the Japanese homeland. So there were a lot of considerations for that.
Well, I can understand that. In your book is called Uncommon Valor, Common Virtue, which is a quote from Admiral Nimitz, actually, isn't it?
That's correct. When Nimitz wrote his final report on the battle for Iwo Jima, his full sentence was, "For Americans who fought on Iwo Jima, uncommon valor was a common virtue." There were 27 Medals of Honor awarded on Iwo Jima, which is one-third of all the Medals of Honor awarded to the Marines in World War II. It was a fierce, fierce battle.
Well, how many Marines were involved in the invasion?
There were 80,000 Marines involved in the invasion, and the Japanese garrison on Iwo Jima was about 22,000. But the Japanese general, a guy named Kurobayashi, was a brilliant general, and he had prepared an incredible defense. In fact, Holland Smith, who commanded the Marine attack force, said that that Kurobayashi was the most formidable general that the Marines faced throughout the whole Pacific campaign.
Well, tell us a little bit about the mindset, I guess you could say, of what the Japanese were thinking about what was going to happen on Iwo Jima.
Well, the Japanese who were there knew that they would not be leaving Iwo Jima. And it was the Japanese themselves considered it an honor and it was required that they would die in battle. And Kurobayashi even wrote to his family, once assigned to Iwo Jima, he wrote to his family that they should not expect to see him return from Iwo Jima, and indeed he did not. Of the 22,000 Japanese on the island, only 1,200 survived the battle. So those that didn't commit suicide, of course, were killed in the fighting
mm-hmm.
itself.
And this was really brutal fighting, too.
It was brutal fighting because the island was bombed heavily for a number of weeks and incredibly heavily in the last 3 days before the Marines landed. But the Japanese had dug themselves in so deeply into the landscape that it had an effect. It didn't have much of an effect. And Iwo Jima was built for a defense. It was a fort in every sense of the word before anybody made a fort out of it. Each cave had to be taken separately. Each pillbox had to be taken separately. And it was done, you know, one at a time, hand-to-hand combat. And, of course, the casualties were staggering. Almost 7,000 Marines died, and 22,000 were wounded. It was the only battle in the Pacific in which the American casualties were greater than the Japanese casualties. The main difference being that almost all the Japanese casualties were deaths, and most of the American casualties were wounded.
There are some incredible pictures in your book, not only from Joe Rosenthal, but from a lot of other photographers that took pictures during the invasion of Iwo Jima. And it's just to look at them, it's frightening to think about how they even survived getting on the beach.
Well, the beach was it was because the beach was very flat, and Suribachi was at the end of the invasion beach, so the Japanese could do two things. They could fire down on the Marines landing from Suribachi, and at the same time, Suribachi acted as a watchtower. They could call in artillery fire and mortar fire from other positions on the island. So it was a deadly beach to attack.
And also the sand wasn't what we would consider normal sand. It was volcanic ash more than anything else, wasn't it?
It was volcanic ash, and it was made up of an ash substance and also tiny modulars. One Marine described landing on the beach was like running in a bin of wheat. It was very difficult to move forward, and in addition, the beach was terraced so that you would have a 15-foot rather steep hill, and then a little level, and then another 15-foot steep hill as the Marines tried to get up onto the more solid part of the island.
Well, the island kind of looks like I'm looking at a picture here inside the book, and it kind of looks like a pork chop, I guess you could say, with Suribachi at the southern tip of the island, and then it kind of gets a little wide and kind of narrows off toward the northwest, possibly. And it does. It looks like it just was a control center for the whole island.
Well, that's exactly what it was, and of course, the Marines finally took Suribachi on the fifth day of the battle, but the battle still went on for four more weeks. I mean, the capture of Suribachi was nowhere near the end of the fighting.
No, it sounds like it just went on and on.
Yeah.
And I was reading a quote by Joe Rosenthal earlier today, and he was saying how lucky he was not just, you know, to survive the beach, because he said it was like when he landed on the beach on the first day, that it was like running through the rain and he didn't get wet somehow.
That's Joe's line, all right, and it's true. Of course, Marines were falling all around him. In fact, one of Joe's favorite picture, and the picture that he always felt it told the story of Iwo Jima, was one in which several Marines are slain in the foreground of his picture, and other Marines are running past them. And Joe often said it was just incredible. He said Marines would fall and others would come running, and more would fall and others would come running. He said the Marines just kept coming and coming and coming, and that struck him as the most memorable part of that terrible invasion day.
Well, I just think it's amazing, considering that many of the Marines that were involved in the invasion of Iwo Jima had been involved in a number of other invasions, other D-Days themselves. In fact, I got an email today from someone told me that many of the Marines that went into Iwo Jima were new Marines.
That's true, but there were some veterans too.
Oh no, I'm not saying that, but you know, it's kind of like the new Marines were, because they didn't know what they were getting into,
yeah,
and hadn't experienced it. But you know, my father was involved in the Coast Guard, as we mentioned in our talk earlier in the week, and he was driving the landing craft into Iwo Jima.
Well, the Coast Guardsmen, you know, that was a bravery of another kind. I mean, those guys were open targets. Like I say, the Japanese had zeroed in not the beach, but the whole waterfront area, mm-hmm. and they could call shots, you know, any place they wanted to, just bang, just like that. Many of the Coast Guard craft were hit before they even got to the beach.
Well, I know, and he never talked about it much, but I heard about it from other friends, you know, exactly what had occurred. Well, let's talk about the photograph. And let's follow Joe on that fifth day or fourth day when he started up Mount Suribachi.
Well, it was D+4, which was the fifth day of the battle. It was D-Day, then D+1, and up to 4, which is the fifth day. And the day started out with Joe by wanting to do a picture of the Secretary of the Navy, Forrestal, was on a ship watching the invasion, actually on the scene there. Hmm. And Joe wanted to get a picture of him with Holland Smith, the general who commanded the Marine detachment. And to do that, he had to go from the ship he was on to the ship that they were on. And to do that, he had to get onto a small craft that would take him to the ship where the two men were. And he would go across a catwalk that linked the larger ship he was on to the smaller ship that would take him where he wanted to go. And as he was crossing this catwalk, the first thing he did was he swung his camera bag over to a sailor on the small ship. And as he stepped forward to make the jump into the landing craft, he slipped and fell in the water between the two ships, which were only about 6 feet apart.
Jeez.
So you can imagine, he's in the water, and he's looking up, and here he is, 6 feet, ships on either side, and the ocean was a rolling ocean, And Joe said, "Boy," he tells the story. He said, "I thought, what a way to go! It looks like they got me at last." And he saw the tillerman up there spinning that wheel all the might he could. And Joe said, "I hope he has it right." Well, he did have it right, and the smaller ship pulled away, and they pulled Joe out soaking wet. And he chuckles when he tells the story, because in those days he smoked cigarettes in a cigarette holder.
And, a la FDR, right?
Yeah, a la FDR is right. And as he got up on the ship, he still had the cigarette holder clenched in his teeth, and this soggy butt was still hanging in there, soaking wet, dripping off the side of the holder. And he thought that was pretty funny. By that time, it was funny, but it wasn't funny when he was down in the water.
No, I wouldn't think so. We're talking with Hal Buell, who's the author of a new book called Uncommon Valor, Common Virtue, Iwo Jima and the Photograph That Captured America. If you have any comments out there that you'd like to add to the program, you can give us a call at 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600. Well, Hal, Joe was not a big guy.
Joe was a little guy, about 5'5", wore a mustache. Elegant in appearance and civilian life, and if you went into a room of news photographers, kind of a noisy, brash bunch, Joe was quite the opposite. He was very quiet, very unassuming, a painfully modest man, a gentleman both, well liked by just about everybody because he just got along with folks. But after he made his picture of Smith and Forrestal, he said, "Well, I better get over to the island and see what I can make today." And as he was going in another ship to the to the shoreline, he heard the chatter on the radio that that the Marines were going to put a flag up on top of Suribachi. And he said, well, that's the picture I want to get. So he made his way to Suribachi, and at the foot of Suribachi, he joined up with two Marine photographers, Bill Janaus, who was a motion picture cameraman, mm-hmm. and Bob Campbell, a still photographer. And they went up together, and as they were going up, down the mountain comes Lou Lowry, who was a still photographer for Leatherneck magazine. And Lou said, you guys are late, the flag's up, but it's a hell of a view up there. He said, you probably want to go up and see it. So they kept going up, and Joe wondered what kind of picture he was going to make. He said it probably wouldn't be a picture of a flag going up because the flag was already up. So he went up to the top, and sure enough, there was a flag. And at that point, Joe said he was really struck when he saw that flag up there. He said because what he could recall was the terrible price that was paid in those first few days of the battle to get that flag up on Suribachi. And even to this day, he would recall when he told his story, he always recalled the cost that was involved in getting that flag up there. But up he went, and when he got to the top, he discovered that there were several Marines working with another flag. Well, what had happened in the interim was that a commander on the beach said, I want to get a larger flag up there so that everybody on this island can see that flag. And so he sent a runner up with a much larger flag, twice the size of the one that was put up, and that's what Joe saw. And he tried to figure out how he was going to make this picture. And you know, a lot of times people say, and Joe says, that, I was lucky. Is this a lucky break? Well, it wasn't lucky. Serendipity is part of all photography. But Joe said, I want a picture of the first flag going up with the second flag coming down, because the Marines said that's the way it was going to happen, because they always wanted the flag flying on Suribachi. Mm-hmm. But he looked at that, and he said, no, that's kind of like a football play. You don't know which way it's going to go. I could miss it. So he went around, and he made the picture from the front. But to do that, he had to calculate the distance to make sure he didn't miss the picture when it swung up. He moved down inside the cone a little bit. He brought over some boulders. He put a bunch of sandbags on top of the boulders, and he made himself a little platform to give himself some height. He got up on top of these boulders, and at that moment, Bill Janaus walks in front of him and stands just off to the right where Joe could almost touch him. And he says, hey, Joe, I'm not in your way, am I? And Joe says, he looks over to talk to Janaus and said, no, hey, there she goes. And up the flag goes, and Joe raises the camera and makes the picture. Janaus raises his camera and cranks out 198 frames of 16-millimeter Kodachrome film to photograph it on film. That's how the picture was made.
It's important to point out that along with your book, you've got a DVD to play with it that's got both of those moments frozen in time. You get to see actual footage of the movie and how it matches up pretty much exactly with Joe's picture.
Yeah, it does. It's almost precisely.
And I think that's really fascinating. I'm going to ask for there was some controversy about this picture, and I'm going to bring on Dan Cortez, who is a friend of Joe's, and ask him a couple of questions real quick.
Sure.
I want you to hang on the line, Hal. I'll be right with you.
Okay.
Hi, Dan.
Hello. How are you?
I am fine. I'm talking with Dan Cortez. How did you know Joe?
Well, I first met Joe in 1974. I was in the Marine Corps at the time, and I was a Marine drill instructor, and I was wounded in Vietnam. And
welcome
I
home.
Had, because of my wounds, I was no longer able to fulfill the physical complement required, and the Marine Corps, in its infinite wisdom, said, what we're going to do with you, we're going to make you a broadcaster, a news writer, a photographer. You're going into public affairs. And I went to the school at Fort Benjamin Harrison, Indiana, and it was a tough transition, actually. But Manifest Destiny is ironic because my family, in 1948, had started the first Spanish media in America,
wow.
Which transcended and became Univision and Telemundo. That's what it is today.
Oh, my goodness.
And ironically, I'm back in the family business. And in 1974, I took a photograph of a plane crash in Camp Pendleton, California, that won the Department of Defense's highest award for news photography. It's called the Thomas Jefferson Award, which is the military equivalent of the Pulitzer. I went to San Francisco after I was awarded the prize, and I met Rosenthal, the legend. And we immediately became quite close. We became friends, and we were all in awe of him. Everybody that was in Marine public affairs, every Marine, period, that ever met him, and he was a consummate gentleman. Hal is correct. I would disagree with him a little bit that, you know, in the all the years that I knew him, he was, and I'm going to use the words of one of closest to him at the honors ceremony where we eulogized him, and that was Carl Nolte, who from the Chronicle, who worked with Joe, and he gave part of the eulogy and said, you know, Joe was a little bit disheveled. He was, his clothes were well worn, these are his words, but he was the consummate gentleman, grandfatherly type, and he was. And of course, he was 40 years my senior, and he was, it was quite a remarkable relationship over the years. And I got to know him closely. I was stationed at Treasure Island in San Francisco, where I was the public affairs chief and officer for a while. In 1981, I helped retire Joe, along with the Chronicle staff, and that was there. It was a quite remarkable event that was hosted by the 12th District, 12th Marine Corps District, a gentleman by the name of Lee Erickson, United States Marine Corps retired. And Ralph Apizzato put this program on, and his closest associate at the time was Kevin Leary, and he also worked for the Chronicle. He was the president of the San Francisco Press Club. He was a legend, and I could tell you a number of humorous stories about Joe and his way. He was the guest of honor at my wedding, and I am in receipt, and I'm the only man that I know of that has Joe Rosenthal's entire life story on tape, and I've been listening with great interest to the remarks of Hal. And see, I have Joe's exact words as he talks about from birth to the campaigns that he served. And you know, he was 33. He spent 33 years as with the Chronicle, and of course, the flag raising was his masterpiece. But he also made landings with the Marines on Guam and Peleliu, and he was a consummate professional.
I need to break in here. I'm sorry, but we need to take a quick break here at the bottom of the hour. And when we get back, we're going to talk about the photograph and some of the rumors that went around with it. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Marine Corps Captain David Porter led his men up 200-foot cliffs and routed the enemy. Details after this.
There's always a moment of truth where it's either put up or shut up. We were yelling our hearts out. Even in our weakness, even in our pain, we continued to push. I don't know where the pain went to, but all I know is that I had what it took. I am a United States Marine.
AFC Darrell Willis proved he could be one of us. Can you? Call 1-800-MARINES.
In command of the columns upon their uniting ashore in Mexico, Captain Porter made a surprise attack on the fortified cliffs and completely routed the enemy, killing 30 and capturing and destroying the powder magazine, 40 guns, rice, and food. He successfully led his men up the cliffs by means of bamboo ladders to a height of 200 feet. Tons of rocks were suspended in platforms held in position by vines and cables in readiness to be dropped upon people below. After driving the insurgents from their position, Captain Porter led his men across the river, scaled the cliffs on the opposite side, and destroyed the camps there. He and the men under his command overcame incredible difficulties and dangers in destroying positions which, according to reports from old prisoners, had taken 3 years to perfect, were held as a final rallying post, and were never before penetrated by troops.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
If you need home repairs, call a veteran. Why not? Call Pat the Handyman. He is a licensed and insured remodeler who served in the United States Army. He can paint your home, install a kitchen, or finish those repairs you started and then dropped. I know about that a lot. Call Pat the Handyman at 734-216-1471. That's 734-216-1471.
For all you boating enthusiasts out there, now it's getting to be that time of year, and I want you to make sure that you give my friend Ray Schrader a call at Schrader Yacht Sales in Point Pleasant, New Jersey, our national sponsor here. Give Ray a call at 732-899-8010. Did you know, I bet you didn't know this, the first Chris Craft was built in 1874, and today that tradition continues. Wherever you go, it is a boat that is a destination in itself. Designed without compromise, it is exhilaration taken to the extreme. Whichever model you choose, each one will catch the eye, steal the heart, and fill your lungs with healthy outdoor air. Come into Schrader Yacht Sales to experience all of this for yourself. So give Ray a call again at 732-899-8010, and he promises he'll come all the way to Michigan if you need him to deliver his boats. That's Schrader Yacht Sales at SchraderYachts.com. SchraderYachts.com.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we're talking with Hal Buell and Dan Cortez about the famous photograph taken by Joe Rosenthal on Iwo Jima on February 23rd, 1945. I've got a call on the line I'd like to get on. And Gary, you got a comment you want to make?
Hi, Dale. Great conversation so far. Joe Rodriguez from Ann Arbor here was one of the guys in the squad that raised the flag. And I got to know Joe quite well. He told me, let me say one thing before I get into this story about the controversy, but Joe was the guy that found the pipe, I'm told, that they put the flag on. And when they went to raise the flag, they asked Joe to give him a hand. And he said, no, I'll find some rocks to prop it up with. And when Joe died a couple of years, the tombstone grant monument is in black granite. It's genius. It shows the famous photograph from the other side. And in the foreground on the edge of the hill is Joe picking up a big rock about the size of your head to take it up and prop up the flag. Just a stroke of genius. It's here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. But Joe got wounded a few days later and was sent to Pearl Harbor to recover. While he was there, there was a lot of commotion, and one of the nurses said, yes, what's going on? And she said, the boys are coming back from Pearl Harbor. And he was confused, knowing the fierce fighting. He said, well, not all of them. And she said, no, the ones in the photograph. He had no idea what they were talking about, but soon learned that there was this photograph taken of the flag raising. He wasn't aware of what they were talking about, but there's a photograph taken afterwards where everybody posed in front of the flag. Joe's the guy that can be seen on the left side with his thumbs hooked in his jacket. And somebody asked Joe, and I believe it was a reporter, was that photograph posed? Well, he didn't know about Rosenthal's photograph. He knew about the one where they posed in front of the flag. And he said, well, of course it was posed. And that just fueled the fire that it was a posed photograph. And I just thought that might be interesting to the author and to the listeners.
All right. Thanks, Gary. And that's something that we were going to talk about right now.
Okay, good deal.
Anyway, I've seen the tombstone of Joe Rodriguez, and also I understand that the question was put to Joe Rosenthal about once that picture had been taken and been shipped out, somebody had asked him about, the great picture he had taken was opposed, and he thought that he meant the football team picture that he had taken. Mike, correct? Right, Hal?
That's correct. Joe had not seen his picture. Nobody on Iwo Jima had seen it by the time Joe was going back. Joe was going back to Pearl Harbor to prepare for the Okinawa invasion. He went to Saipan, where he saw tear sheets, but they were of the invasion day. And then he went to Guam, and everybody's telling him what a great job he did. And he'd received messages of congratulations from New York, from the general manager of the AP. And he wondered, he said, well, the gung-ho picture, which he called it, which was the pose picture, he said that was a nice photo, but it wasn't worth all that fuss, and he wasn't sure that he'd made the flag-raising picture properly because of the exchange with Janaus. When he got to Guam, all the correspondents were patting him on the back, Joe, what a great picture, wow, holy smokes. He said, did you pose it? And Joe knew he'd made the gung-ho picture. He said, yeah, it was posed. And a few minutes later, somebody comes up with a print, and he says, oh, no, Oh, I didn't pose this one. I posed the other one. Well, the damage was done, and off it went. And
it stayed with him all his life.
Big flap over the picture, of course.
Well, that's true. Dan, you had something about it staying with him his whole life?
Well, it did. And, two days before he passed, I was speaking to Joe because I was on my way there to see him. I was in Los Angeles with the Military Order of the Purple Heart for our annual convention. And I had been talking to Joe, and knowing that Joe had been feeling rather poorly. And, you know, he's getting up there in age, and Kevin Leary is there in San Francisco. I'm here in Virginia. And Joe had come to see me and years back, and he'd stayed with us, and we took him up to the monument, and we had photos, and we laughed and joked. And then over time, we would check on him. And as you know, he became quite a recluse over time, and he would only allow certain people to talk to him. He just became a recluse, and he was always ventilating about the fact that his photograph had been misrepresented. And I told him, well, Joe, let's release the tape. And every year I'd ask him, every year I said, Joe, let's release it. Well, not just yet, not just yet. And I respected his privacy. And he goes into great detail explaining A to Z on Mount Suribachi. And I've been on Suribachi. I went there in 1987, stood where Joe stood. And Hal's exactly right in the description of the beach. And it's just phenomenal. And as a Marine, you know, I was in Vietnam. But, you know, the things I saw pale in comparison to what Joe Rosenthal and my uncles who, you know, were in World War II, those are the true heroes of America, in my opinion, and nothing will dissuade me from that opinion. But Joe was anguished till the day he passed. His last words, he was upset about the fact that the movie that was put out was inaccurate, Flags of Our Fathers, because he was not consulted to the very end. And it anguished me because we tried to make jokes about it. You know, we purchased the brick with Joe's name on it that's going to be placed in front of the new Marine Heritage Museum that's going to open on November the 10th. And we knew Joe was getting up there and he wouldn't make the visit, but we wanted to cheer him up because he was going through some depression because his faculties were leaving him. And we laughed and we joked, and I said we were going to present the brick to him. And I told him when I was leaving Los Angeles, I'll be there in 2 days, I'm going to present you this brick. You know, Kevin, Leary, and I, and he goes, oh, and he made a joke. Now people are going to step all over my good name some more. And he joked about that, and then he made some comments about, you know, pal, I may not be around. And then he said, I want you to give a message to the commandants. And I said, Joe, you're going to live till you're 100. And we joked about it because he would be up and down with his friends, as Hal may know, in the later years. And he said specifically, he said, tell him thank you for letting me hang around. He said, thank you. He said, think of what could I have done for you if you'd have given me a waiver, he said, because we know about his poor eyesight. I might tell you a driving story later. And it's true. And then he said, and these words will stay with me for the rest of my life because I knew him. He was a friend. And these were his last words. And he said, tell them, you know, take care of my Marines down here. And I will take care of your Marines up there. And he said, pal, I'm feeling a little bit tired now.
Well, that sounds just like Joe. He was, of course, he always referred to the Marines as my Marines.
Exactly correct.
Yeah, and he had a great affection for the Marines, and they for him. It was
absolutely
a mutual love affair. And he was annoyed because the story, no matter how many times the correct story was told, it was the story of the posing was corrected by the end of March of 1945.
But it kept being retold inaccurately.
The correction never caught up
with
the original story, and it kept coming up and up and up over and over, and people began to make up stories.
That's right.
I just there was one story had it that the first flag was blowing up, so they had to put up a second flag. Another story was that Joe went down and got the big flag and the pole and lugged them up to the top of the
and
mountain.
Then he posed everyone and all.
And then another story was that the first flag was put up at night, so they had to make a picture of the second flag going up in the daytime.
And
but it wasn't only
over these things. It was
just crazy. And it used to make Joe crazy, and he used to get pretty annoyed from time to time.
You're absolutely correct about that.
But you know, Dan, in the end, I have a long tape of Joe also, a videotape that I did on Joe several years ago. And in it, I asked a naive question, but I asked it because I wanted to hear his response. And that was, Joe, if you had to do all over again, would you rather not have made the picture? And he said, well, that thought's occurred to me. But he said, you know, in the end, even though I get annoyed from time to time with all the telling and retelling, he said, I'm happy that I was part of something that was good. And that was also typical of Joe.
And it was. He had great humility and great pride. But, you know, aside from all that and aside from his anguish, you know, in my last conversation, you know, he was terribly proud of what hung in his wall in his room. He was in a retirement home in Novato. Was a plaque, a photo of the flag raising, and it was making him an honorary Marine, signed by the Commandant. It was his most treasured possession, and he would talk about that. And, you know, in his comments, you know, he was, and this is what annoyed him, as you know, Hal, he saw more combat than many combatants have seen their lives.
More invasion beaches in
Precisely.
The
There's a photograph that Joe took in Guam of the first wave. Now, his back is to the battle. He's being rained upon by mortars, by artillery, by bullets, and he's on the shore first, shooting the landing craft coming in. Now, think about the heroism that it takes to do that. And he's raised up. He's up on his legs, shooting down. And it's remarkable. Just it's mind-boggling that he had the tenacity, the calmness to do this in the middle of combat. And I've been through combat, and I want to tell you, it's terrifying.
I have to break in here again. I break up what you guys are talking about, but we need to take our last break for the evening. We'll be right back in just a moment. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Fear is proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy. So said old Ben Franklin. Well, he would be very happy with the Sidetrack Bar and Grill. Located in Ypsilanti's historic depot town, Sidetrack Bar and Grill offers two happy hours. That's right, two. The first one is from 3 to 7 p.m. and the second from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. closing. Happy hours are 16 selections of 25-ounce drafts at a very special price. And of course, bottled favorites of your lovable suds are also available to you at Sidetrack Bar and Grill. You may also choose from their full-service menu for appetizers, sandwiches, salads, and absolutely the best burgers, period. Deluxe buffet catering for any event is available, from sit-down dinners to theme parties. Sidetrack Bar and Grill does it all. Stop by at 56 East Cross Street or call Sidetrack Bar and Grill at 483-1035 for more details. See you there.
After receiving my disability denial letter from the VA regional office, I felt I had nowhere else to turn. Then I contacted LegalHelpForVeterans.com. They did a thorough review, then went right to work on my case. Now I feel that I have someone fighting to resolve my claim.
Hi, I'm Jim Fossone of Legal Help for Veterans at the law firm of Fossone, Taylor & Bond. We have a nationwide practice in veterans' disability appeals and assisting veterans with getting the disability and pension benefits to which they are entitled. We are the leading veterans law firm in the state of Michigan. Our website, LegalHelpForVeterans.com, that's all one word, LegalHelpForVeterans.com, is your point of contact. Email or call me and we will personally look into your claim, whether the service-related problem is physical or emotional. If your case has been called too difficult or medically complicated, like with PTSD or Gulf War syndrome, you need lawyers that can forcefully present medical evidence and sophisticated arguments. Look us up on the web at www.legalhelpforveterans.com or call me or Mike Viterna at 248-380-0000. We are Veterans Helping Veterans at LegalHelpForVeterans.com.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we're talking with Hal Buell, the author of Uncommon Valor, Common Virtue, Iwo Jima, and the Photograph That Captured America. And it was taken by Joe Rosenthal, who passed away in August of this year. And also joining us is Dan Cortez, who is a friend and fellow Marine of Joe Rosenthal. And when you were talking just before we took our break, there was a story about another picture I heard about that was hanging in his apartment of Joe and a number of other war photographers coming out of a tent. I believe it was after Guam or one of the other invasions there, and he thought that that was one of his favorite photos also.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that because at his honors ceremony, there were five Pulitzer Prize winners there. Sal Vader was there, Reed Saxon, Dina Fitzmaurice, David Hume Kennerly, and Nick Ut. It was remarkable to see the outpouring of love and respect. You know, President Bush, H.W. Bush, sent a personal message, and President Ford sent a personal message. He was presented the Navy's Distinguished Public Service Award to his family, you know, Ann Rosenthal and Joe Jr., and it was a standing room only crowd. General Snowden, who was on Iwo Jima, was there that honored him, and of course, I gave part of the eulogy later with the humorous stories about his retirement and his driving exploits, and it was quite moving. It was unbelievably moving. What San Francisco did, it was front page news, and he's still being talked about. And, you know, I'm honored that he finally gave me the permission to release his story, which I will be doing shortly. These are his words, so there can be no inaccuracies. There'll be no conflict. And, Hal, I think you've done a tremendous service with what you've done and your work, and you're to be congratulated.
Well, we talked. Kennerly and Nicky Ut were at a big seminar we have here in the East for young photographers last week, and we had a little. And Ann Rosenthal, Joe's daughter, was there, and we had a little ceremony and commentary about Joe, and told the kids the story, and it was a very touching time.
Well, I think from my own experience, I wasn't quite born yet. I came along shortly after World War II. But I do remember the photograph, and I especially remember my first time I ever went to Washington and saw the statue. And it was so inspiring to me. It's not that I suddenly wanted to jump up and become a Marine, but I knew that if I ever had the opportunity to serve, that there was no question that I would, you know, would respond to the call. But Joe wasn't the only one that there was some questions and concerns about it, about this photograph. The men who actually put it up, surprisingly, of the six, three of them were killed on Iwo Jima, and the other three were called back to sell bonds. Isn't that correct, Hal?
That's right. Three were killed, and one was seriously wounded, and then they were brought back, as was Joe, by the way.
Yeah.
Joe was, the three Marines were brought back to become part of the 7th War Bond Tour, and Joe was called back also to participate in that. He was all set to go to Okinawa, and he wanted to go to Okinawa, and there's a classic message exchange, and which the AP said, come on back to New York, we want to get you involved in this, they want you to be in this bond drive. And Joe said, well, I'm really getting ready to go to Okinawa, and back came the message from New York. This is not a request, Joe. This is an assignment. So Joe hopped on the next plane, and back he went. And, of course, he walked into some of the trouble with the picture, but it got clarified down. And an interesting story how that all came about. I don't know if you want to get into that now. But it was clarified pretty quickly, but it just never caught up, Dan. You know that.
And you're exactly right. And that's why it's important for people like us to, you know, establish the public record. This is part of history that's ongoing. We owe it to Joe. You know, what he is, that's one, it was the single greatest photograph of the 20th century.
No question.
You know, Navy Secretary James Forrestal said of Joe, he was as gallant as the men going up that hill. And
Joe,
if I can share an anecdote with you about when the monument was unveiled, and you know in 1950, one was it? I
54.
Believe
54.
54. Thank you for the point of clarity. You know, Joe's there, and he shares this with me, and he says it on the tape, and he's terribly honored. You know, his children are there, and his family's there, and they unveil it, and of course, what's not there?
Joe.
Joe's name.
Oh, that's right.
In fact, Joe was almost, but not quite, was going to tell his young son to look for his name on the statue.
Exactly right.
And it wasn't there, and Joe said, oh, my God, thank God I didn't say anything. And do you know that wasn't corrected until Ronald Reagan issued an executive order?
Exactly right. And when Joe came with me, and we took him back up to the monument, and he's sitting there, and he says, what do you want to do, Joe? He says, let's go see a little statue in Arlington. I said, okay, pal. So we drove him up there, and we sat right by his name, and I must have taken 100 photographs of him and, you know, there and us together. And people would come up, and I said, do you know who this man is? And I said, this is Mr. Joe Rosenthal, who shot the photograph. Children would come up, and he'd hug the children, and some people would come up, and they'd say, and they'd be chattering, oh, this is Mr. Joe Rosenthal. Oh, he died a couple of years ago. And Joe would look and says, well, that's too bad. I heard he was a pretty nice guy. And, you know, he's still, up to that time, he was still, you mentioned he's a la Roosevelt. He had that cigarette holder, and he had his beret. He still had it. And up to that time, and that was Joe Rosenthal, and he had a remarkable sense of humor and timing, and I sure miss him.
Well, you know, Joe's picture also was part of the World Trade Center. You know, when Tom Franklin made that picture of the fireman with the flag at that afternoon of the day the towers fell here in New York, it was Joe's. The comparison was obvious and instant. And the strength of Joe's picture added to the strength and power of Tom Franklin's picture.
Yes,
and it was partly responsible for some of the power of Tom's picture in the World Trade Center.
And Dale,
yes.
While Joe was, you know, and Hal knows this well, you know, Joe was had seen so much. He was the consummate pacifist. He abhorred war. And that's why, in his later years, I mean, in all the years I had known him, he was a tremendous supporter of the Marine Corps, the military, once you're engaged. But he deplored it. And that was part of the issues that I had with him, trying to release these tapes when he felt comfortable. And finally, he did give me permission. And I'm very proud to share with you that, you know, the profits are not going to me. They're going to the military order of the Purple Heart. You know, Tom Poulter, our national commander. We're going to be working closely to make sure that disabled veterans get these needed funds where they can. You know, the governor of Virginia, you know, the statues here in Arlington sent a beautiful letter that I read representing the governor and representing MOPH. The National Hall of Honor of the is opening on November 10th. For the Military Order of the Purple Heart, right outside of Newburgh, New York. And I was sharing all this with Joe, and he was excited and he was proud, but then he'd go off on a tangent about how he abhorred what's going on. You know, he abhorred war. And it's remarkable that a man who had seen so much and could be so demure in some respects about what he had seen. And,
well, I hate to have to, kind of wrap this up here because we're coming up toward the top of the hour. And it's very timely, of course, with the you know, the Clint Eastwood movie Flags of Our Fathers coming out next Friday on the 20th, and it'll be very interesting to see the response to that. And I'm anxious to hopefully get both of you and some other people that are maybe involved back on to Veterans Radio to talk about you know, the power that these pictures and these statues
and I can't wait to see the movie
and these things have on the American public, because as we've always said on Veterans Radio, there's never been a veterans organization that says Veterans for War. And, you know, we just like people to think about it before they jump into these things sometimes. And anyway, I want to thank both of you very much for being on Veterans Radio. Hal Buell, Uncommon Valor, Common Virtue. It's a great book. There's a great CD that goes with it, with the story and the interview that he has with Joe Rosenthal. And Dan Cortez, I want to thank you very much.
Look for my book.
I will be doing that. Give us a call when he comes out, and we'll be happy to do that. To both of you, I want to give you both of Veterans Radio, thank you very much for being on our program this evening.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you so much, Dale.
Thank you. We'll be talking to you again soon.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, I think that was rather interesting, don't you folks? We talked about Iwo Jima tonight and Joe Rosenthal. This program will be archived in the next couple of days. I am assuming that it's been recorded correctly, and I want to thank everybody for listening in this evening. We want to make sure that you, if you do, take the opportunity next Friday to go see the Flags of Our Father, the Clint Eastwood movie. As I was kidding around earlier, Clint wasn't returning my phone calls, and neither was Steven Spielberg. I can't understand why. But maybe after this interview, they might do that. We're very excited to have them on, and we'll be back again next week to talk about that. We want to make sure also, for those of you that have had some difficulties getting the archived programs, we are in the process of re-loading them onto our website. Since we changed servers, we have to reload some of the older programs, so you won't be able to hear those. But I do want to make sure that everybody gets the opportunity to listen to these programs. Okay, I want to make sure this evening that we want to thank our sponsors, of course, and we strongly request that all of you contact our sponsors, whether it be Legal Help for Veterans or Sidetrack Bar and Grill or Pat the Handyman or Gary Lilly or Ray Schrader, and especially Quantum Physical Therapy. I want to welcome them to the Veterans Radio program. They do really do good work if you get the opportunity to, or if you need them. So I want to make sure that you do that. Also, I want to thank Ingrid, and I want to thank Alan, and we'll make sure that you all stay tuned for the Bone Conduction Music Show. And I'm going to be cutting out of here a little bit early tonight. So you've been listening to Veterans Radio. You are dismissed.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of our guests and are not necessarily those of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.